millions of people know that there is to come the mark of the beast. Many of them believe that is going to be something imposed upon us in our cyber society, like a microchip beneath the skin of our foreheads or the skin of our hands, but maybe a national identity card. It may be some kind of a little microchip in a card that gives every bit of information about us from the standpoint of our medical records, our educational background, if you were in the military, your blood type, your religion, any kind of an arrest record, things to which you are allergic. For example, the Vatican is now going to be handing out a card for which they're charging anywhere from $8 to about $27. I put that in the next issue of World Watch, so don't quote me on the price. Depending upon what kind of service you would like for the upcoming year, 2000, the so-called new millennium, which it is not, they're expecting more than 1 million visitors to Rome. And in order to make the visit more easy or easier for all of these pilgrims from nations all over the world, if you buy this Vatican card, it will help you with regard to motels, hotels, buses, trains, and cashing your money and anything. And if someone were to be in St. Peter's Square while the Pope is addressing them, have a heart attack, if they've got this card in their pocket or their wallet or purse, why, they could look at it right quickly and zip it through a machine and find out if you are allergic to penicillin or if you are blood type O or whatever. And they're trying to do it to be helpful. Some people look at that as being a harbinger of something worse which may eventually come. I have not been one in the many years in which I have addressed the issue of the mark of the beast, the image of the beast, and the number of his name, to try to pretend I am Chicken Little and to frighten people into believing that, for example, the scanners at the supermarket that tell you that you are buying a can of Campbell's soup or a loaf of bread for so much money, and automatically then take that out of inventory and automatically ring it up in the cash register, is some kind of a precursor to the mark of the beast. But it's kind of like that t-shirt I once saw. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. So just because the real biblical meaning of the mark of the beast is not some kind of a microchip, doesn't mean they might not try to enforce it upon you. If you will read my booklet, What is the Mark of the Beast? If you haven't, please do so. And anyone listening to this tape later on, if you have not yet read my booklet, The Mark of the Beast, by all means call our office at 903-561-7070 and get your own copy. It will explain it all. But there are national identity cards being issued here and there. And even refugees, when they pour across the borders into Albania or Macedonia, are being given papers because oftentimes they were stripped of all of their papers and documents before they came to the border. I want you to remember some events in history involving some gigantic statuary, some fabulous miracles that have allegedly taken place, some great monuments, some great basilicas, cathedrals, and churches that have been built over the site. And to think about that one great church, which unlike any other, seems to feature weeping statues, bleeding statues, appearances, and mysterious speaking from saints or the Madonna in various places all over the world. For many years, I've told people about how the first time I went down to Mexico City with Dr. Benjamin Rea in 1954, and we went and saw what is called La Basílica de la Virgen de Guadalupe, which is the great basilica to the patron saint of Mexico, and saw these poor women, and there is a 5-mile area where they walk in between the divided highway with streetcars and cars and buses going by on rough cobblestones. And it is like a penance because these women literally crawl on their knees. They were all women, I didn't see any men, for 5 miles until they come to this vast big area out in front of this gigantic basilica. And then they finally, leaving a trail of blood, work their way into the basilica and up to the huge big altar where there is what, if for all practical purposes, looks like an artist had drawn a picture of what it says in Revelation 12 and verse 1, a woman standing clothed with the sun with the moon at her feet. This allegedly is the way the Madonna, meaning Mary, the mother of Jesus, appeared to a peasant down there, and so they built that gigantic basilica in memory of that. I brought with me the Catholic Encyclopedia to read to you a little bit to refresh your memory about Lourdes. You've heard of this before, I'm sure. It's called Notre Dame de Lourdes, which is Our Mother, or Our Dame of Lourdes. Notre Dame, of course, as you know, is the name of the famous basilica in Paris, but also it is the name of a major Catholic university in the United States. In the department of Hautes-Pyrénées, France is far famed for the pilgrimage of which it is a center, and for the extraordinary events that have occurred and will, and still occur, rather, there. The pilgrimage of Lourdes is founded on the apparitions of the Blessed Virgin to a poor 14-year-old girl, Bernadette Sobrioux. The first apparition occurred on 11th of February, 1858. There were 18 of them in all, the last of which took place on the 16th of July in the same year. Bernadette often fell into an ecstasy. The mysterious visions she saw in the hollow of the rock Massabielle was that of a young and beautiful lady, lovelier than I have ever seen, she said. But the girl was the only one who saw the vision, although sometimes many others stood there with her. Now and then the apparition spoke to the seer, who was the only one who heard the voice. Thus she one day told her to drink of a mysterious fountain, mysterious, a word which should be emphasized, in the grotto itself. It's always in a grotto, in a cave or a hollow in the ground. It's dark. There's some water ebbing out of the ground there, the existence of which was unknown and of which there was no sign, but which immediately gushed forth. On another occasion, the apparition bade Bernadette go and tell the priest she wished a chapel to be built on the spot and processions to be made to this grotto. At first, the clergy were incredulous. It was only 4 years later, in 1862, that the bishop of the diocese declared the faithful, quote, justified in believing the reality of the apparition, end quote. A basilica was built upon the rock of Massabielle by a man who is named here a parish priest, and in 1873, the great national French pilgrimages were inaugurated, and from that time on, there have been an average of more than 1 million a year, and sometimes far more than that, visiting Lourdes. Up to the time of the writing of this book, which is very, very old, there had been 4,919,000 visitors there, and many of them, a very lengthy article here claims, have experienced remarkable healings, most of them for mental and nervous disorders, but others they claim of actual deafness, blindness, and other very serious diseases, and there is quite a lengthy article about it which sets forth their arguments that this has, in fact, been documented. One more paragraph. The present writer, that is of this article, his name is Georges Bertrin, probably a Frenchman, has published the number of cases of each disease or infirmity, among them tuberculosis, tumors, sores, cancers, deafness, blindness, etc. So that is the Catholic Encyclopedia article on Lourdes. How many of you know about the Colossus of Rhodes? It was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It was only the height of a 10-and-1/2-story building, but truly a gigantic statue for its time. It was right at the entry into the harbor on the island of Rhodes, but it was later on destroyed, but it was made of bronze, and so a fabulous, tremendous, big, tall statue. I think if you remember back a few months when I was first beginning to deal with the issue of Y2K, that I put a picture on the front page of World Watch, which is a picture of a gigantic, huge building. It has the big supporting columns jutting through the roof with the cables that disappear on both sides, and is probably one of the biggest buildings on the face of the earth that is very rapidly nearing completion, right on the Greenwich parallel, or the meridian rather, the Greenwich meridian in Greenwich, England. So that at the precise moment of the ticking down to midnight on December 31st, this coming year, there will be a gigantic celebration to welcome the new millennium. Now, I've told you before, it isn't the new millennium. It is the last year until, well, that's the next to the last year, the beginning of the millennium. The beginning of the millennium, there is no year zero, is year one, not year 20 or 200, which or 2000, which just completes the previous one. But they're not going to pay any attention to that. They're bound and determined they are going to have this celebration 1 year early. I said before, too, that there is nothing whatsoever significant in any of the calendars of the world, let alone our Gregorian, pagan, Romish calendar about the year 2000. It's not magical. There is nothing spiritual about it. There is nothing predicted in the Bible about it, notwithstanding people turning to everybody from Gene Dixon and Nostradamus, and people who are actually claiming it is going to be the day of the second coming of Christ, or that great events are going to happen. Great events are going to happen. But they may happen because of Y2K primarily, and even maybe before that, Y2K may be small in connection with the actual self-fulfilled prophecy as a result of paranoia and hype that a lot of people are going to perpetrate, not unlike the death cult that went over there and were going to shoot it out with the Israeli police thinking that they were going to trigger the Battle of Armageddon. You talk about stupid. How can anyone be that dumb to think that a group of so-called Christians are supposed to take up AK-47s and shoot a lot of policemen down in the streets, and this is going to trigger some kind of a battle, and all of a sudden the nations will be there, Armageddon will happen, and Jesus Christ will descend and say, thanks a lot for shooting all those policemen. I couldn't come till you triggered the war. You know, anyway, some people wanted to go up and board the mothership that was in the trail of Kahootek, and so they were found with their driver's licenses in their possession. They were told they would need those to get aboard. And plastic over their faces, lying in their beds like cordwood over there in San Diego. So there probably will be others. There are thousands, reputedly, of people who have bought one-way tickets to Israel and are going to go to Jerusalem to be there by the time 2000 starts. We live in a time of incredible hype. You and I have never seen advances in technology and in all communications field like we have in the last 20 or 30 years. Only about, well, 40 or so years ago, when the movie The Ten Commandments came out, the special effects that they were able to show us when the parting of the Red Sea took place was absolutely spectacular for its time. It showed water just rushing and the dry land appearing and the people there and the wind blowing and Charlton Heston standing there, behold the salvation of the eternal. It was very moving. Today, the special effects in motion pictures and on television are such that it's absolutely mind-boggling. They can do anything with people and automobiles and buildings. They can take big buildings in New York and move them around and make one lean against the other, and they look absolutely real. They can cause gigantic ocean liners to sink with the people aboard and screaming, and you're right there. They can make tanks blow people away and actually see the bodies flying. They can make holes appear in people with gouts of blood falling out, spilling out the other side in slow motion, so you would swear that they've literally shot him right through the chest with a 50 caliber machine gun bullet. And I think people are very, very much into otherworldly phenomena. They are much excited about science fiction, but because we live in a day of laser-guided bombs, some people think they actually read road signs, make turns, go in the exact window that they're supposed to. We live in an age where people think you can wage clinical war with clinically precise surgical precision so that no one gets hurt. You can send unmanned reconnaissance aircraft. They're even proposing now to develop, and they are working on developing, unmanned fighter bombers so that unmanned aircraft will fly over and put a laser designator on a target, and another aircraft will launch the bomb and it will fly unerringly down the elevator shaft and destroy that target without even a man there. So you can kill the enemy, but you don't have any of your people killed. As Will Rogers once opined, we know that mankind is making progress because every time we have a war, we learn of new and different ways to kill one another. And that was, of course, a little bit of irony. If you will turn back to the second chapter of the book of Daniel, I want to go back to one of the great wonders of the world of that day, not reported elsewhere, but reported here in the book of Daniel. Now, this first is a vision that we see that he had, a dream or a vision, but the vision led to something. So he liked the vision, apparently, because I'm going to begin in verse 31. We all know this. We're pretty well acquainted with it, that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and he demanded that the astrologists and the stargazers and all those come, and he said, you must tell me not only the interpretation of the dream, but I'm not going to tell you what the dream was. Well, of course, they were completely stymied. How can you expect us to tell you what the dream is when we have no idea what you dreamed? Well, there's something else here I could go into in great detail, but it was a political move on his part to get rid of the opposition, which he managed to do. Verse 31, Daniel begins to tell him that there is a God in heaven, verse 28, that reveals secrets and makes known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Verse 31, you saw and behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before you, and the form thereof was terrible. The image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. You saw till a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and broke them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. So they were just blown completely off the foundation. And the stone that seemed to be there began to grow, and it just loomed larger and larger until it became such a great stone or a great mountain that it filled the whole earth. That's what you dreamed, and we will tell you the interpretation of it. Thou, O king, art a king of kings. He was an emperor. He was a king over a vast empire. For the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and fowls of the heaven has he given into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. So king and kingdom are synonymous. He says the image's head was of fine gold, and that is a symbol of the ancient Babylonian Empire. You can look up in Halley's Bible Handbook about Babylon, and you can find in history books about Babylon, in Rawlinson's Five Great Empires, for example, and find out the incredible dimensions of the Great Wall. There was an outer wall and an inner wall, and it was built right across the Euphrates River so that the river flowed through the city, and the river gates were down beneath the level of the water, but the water flowed through. So they would have an enduring water supply. I think you know the story about how the Persians diverted the river course way upstream, and while Belshazzar was having his drunken orgy on one night after the handwriting on the wall appeared, that they walked into the city dry-shod and completely destroyed the city, killed Belshazzar, overthrew the Babylonian Empire, and Cyrus and Darius the Medo-Persian Empire, ruled and became the second great world-ruling empire of that time. He said, after you, verse 39, shall arise another kingdom inferior to you, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. The brass was typical of Alexander's Greco-Macedonian Empire. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all things, and as iron that breaks all of these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. They have the story of Rome backwards. Rome, as they used to say, wherever Rome went, Rome built. In truth, wherever Rome went, Rome destroyed. And the iron shows here that it breaks in pieces and bruises. And whereas you saw the feet and toes and part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be broken, as it should read. But there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as you saw iron mixed with miry clay. Now you don't mix iron with miry clay, or you've got a very bad mold and it's going to fall apart. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron, 10 of them, 5 on one side and 5 on another. So the kingdom will be partly strong and partly broken, as it says, or partly weak, as the margin has it. And whereas you saw iron mixed with miry clay, they will mingle themselves with a seed of men. This is talking about an empire. It's talking about an admixture, which is not a healthy one. But they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in the days of these kings, that is the kings portrayed by the 10 toes, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Forasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountains without hands, and that it break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold. Notice how it starts, break in pieces the iron, because it smashed the image on its feet, not its head. It smashed it on the feet, not the knees or the thighs or the belly or the chest or the head, but on the feet. So it listed in reverse order. You saw that the stone was cut out and it broke in pieces the iron, because it is to smash the last 10 kings, represented by the 10 toes. The brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold. The great God has made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof is sure. Probably this vision triggered exactly what happened next. Chapter 3, verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 70 cubits, and that is about the height of a 9-story building. If you use the great cubit of Ezekiel, probably a 10.5 or 11-story building, but a very large, large image. If you put the image or the statue of a man out on an open plain or right in front of the gates into a city that is 9 stories tall, especially in that day, which is long before skyscrapers, it is indeed a huge image. He had it built, and either it was solid gold, which I doubt, or it was gold leaf over whatever they formed it from, which might have been stone or even clay. But it was a golden image. The height was 70 cubits, 60 cubits at 60 times 25, if it's a great cubit of Ezekiel, or 21, as some people say, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits, and he set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So then he issued a decree. Verse 4. O people, nations, and languages, whenever you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up, and whoever falls not down to worship it will be cast into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. Now this is the chapter about Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, whose Babylonian names were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, how they refused to worship that idolatrous image, which was an image of Nebuchadnezzar himself. He built an image to himself. It was not, there is no statement here whatsoever that it was a calf. And because I think it is conclusive, if you look at the fact that the image that Daniel told him he had seen in his dream represented him, you are this head of gold, you can see how it must have triggered the thought. And Nebuchadnezzar immediately set out on a vast building program to erect a gigantic statue to himself. There wasn't anybody greater that he knew in the entirety of the earth, as you will see if you read through the ensuing chapters of the book of Daniel. I won't belabor this except to say that you can read through it again and how they refused. They were cast into the fiery furnace. Someone like unto the Son of Man, as it says in verse 25, was there. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not hurt. Nebuchadnezzar called them out, acknowledged that their God was indeed the great God, and made a decree, verse 29. He gets power back by doing this. He elevates himself above God by doing this. Your God is a great God, therefore I make a decree, verse 29 of chapter 3, that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. Now, in chapter 4, he issued a decree. Nebuchadnezzar, you know, wrote a part of the Bible. Nebuchadnezzar the king, unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell on all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that the high God has wrought toward me. How great are his signs, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. Then he talked about a dream, but this is a different dream. This is a dream about a giant tree, verse 11. It grows until there are fowls in the branches all over the place, spreads out a gargantuan, huge tree. But a watcher and a holy man came down and said, in verse 14, hew down the tree and cut off his branches and shake off his leaves and scatter his fruit and let the beast get away from under it and the fowls from under his branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass, as if to keep the sap from flowing out. in the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, let his portion be with the beast and the grass of the earth, and let his heart be changed from man's, and a beast's heart be given unto him, and let seven times pass over him. Some people have interpreted that as seven literal years, which it was in the case of Nebuchadnezzar's insanity, or of 2,520 years, a time being a year, times 360, times seven, and have looked at the dates from the fall of Babylon until the end of the times of the Gentiles and tried to extrapolate and come up with a time for the second coming of Christ, and they have failed to do so. All kinds of dates have been suggested, including 1972 or 1975, none of which have proved to be true. This again was a dream he called for Daniel to interpret, and Daniel did, and said, verse 22, "It is thou, O king, that are grown and become strong, for your greatness is grown and reaches unto heaven, and your dominion to the end of the earth. And whereas you saw a watcher and an holy one coming down from heaven, saying, hew the tree down and destroy it, yet leave the stump of the roots thereof in the earth," he said when he first told him he was going to interpret the dream in verse 19, "My Lord, it is thereof, the interpretation thereof is to your enemies." Your enemies are going to rejoice over this interpretation. So he said, "Let his portion be with the beast of the field," verse 23, "till seven times pass over him." This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king, that they will drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and they shall make you eat grass as oxen, and they will wet you with the dew of heaven, till seven times shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and gives it to whomsoever he will. The they here is curious, and it may mean other members of the government who nevertheless remained cooperative with or even subservient to Daniel for the space of 7 years while Nebuchadnezzar was insane. It seemed to imply more that Nebuchadnezzar was going to be driven utterly insane because he was not killed, and he came back and ascended the throne once again after the 7 years of insanity were over, and the dream and the interpretation of it plainly promised that. Verse 26, "And whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, your kingdom shall be sure unto thee." So this was not an overthrow by armed enemies, but it was something that happened internally to Nebuchadnezzar for a 7 year span. "After that you have known that the heavens do rule." So God still had to teach this man a lesson. He was only 17 when he began to reign, and he was probably still quite a young man at this moment. But eventually, when his sanity returned to him, he said, verse 37, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase." You can read the entire thing. "He lifted up his eyes to heaven, and his understanding returned to him," he said in verse 34. And verse 34 through 37 is his decree now, finally acknowledging, at least in his carnal repentance as much as he could, how great was God. I'm doing this for a reason. I want to lead up to something here. Revelation, the 13th chapter, is next. We will go to Revelation, the 13th chapter. In Revelation 13, there are two beasts that are portrayed. The first is a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy, a name which is blasphemous to God. "And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard." We'll go back in a minute and see the most powerful constituents of each of these beasts, or the parts. "His feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority." The animals which depicted the four successive world-ruling empires were lions, in the case of Nebuchadnezzar, bears, as in the case of the Medo-Persian Empire, and Russia has always been likened unto a bear and characterized as bear-like, and then, of course, a leopard in the case of Alexander's lightning-like flanking attacks against the ponderous Persian phalanxes. And to this day, in the war colleges of nations, people study Alexander's wartime tactics because as a man of under 33, he'd conquered all the known world from India all the way to Spain and Portugal. And so the body of the leopard is depicted, the mouth of the great head of the lion is depicted, the feet of the bear with which he rolls rocks and turns over giant logs or disembowels a large bull. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. And I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death. Now, we've always understood this, all the commentary generally do, as meaning that Rome, that is, old imperial Rome, pagan Rome, fell in 476 A.D., and that it was restored by General Belisarius, who was sent to Carthage and the provinces of northern Italy in 554. So it says his deadly wound was healed. We believed in history that that was a type of the wounding of the Roman Empire and its restoration after a period of time from 476 to 554 A.D. And all the world wondered after the beast. Now, the Pope is not the beast. The Pope is not the beast. The beast is a military leader of 10 nations, as we're going to see, and even though he is worshipped, and we'll deal with that in a minute, he is not the Pope. Some people might want to say, well, the Pope was shot, and he was injured, he had a deadly wound, but he has recovered. Does this mean the Pope? I think, no. If someone wants to see some kind of a type in it, or some shadowy representation of some sort, that's up to them, but that is not what this means, I believe. And they worshipped, it says, the dragon. Now, this is not the people in San Francisco or elsewhere who are Satanists, and they're all over the country and around the world by now, by the way, and they're on the internet, who openly try to worship the devil and get in contact with him and perform their marriage ceremonies in coffins and the like, and have various covens and deal in what they call Wicca and witchcraft. This is the subtle counterfeit of people who think they are worshiping the true God and worshiping Jesus Christ, and in fact are worshiping a false Christ, which is a counterfeit. The only people who can spot counterfeits, for example, most of us couldn't spot a counterfeit $100 bill. They have to have machinery or some really well-trained person in the banks that can do that. And now they've got a new kind of a bill, which is exactly why they foisted them upon us, instead of the old ones, which have a watermark inside them like they've had in Europe for decades and decades or hundreds of years. And we have been very late to adopt that here in the United States, so that you can simply put it up to the light and see, and that is simply something that the counterfeiters cannot reproduce without the very highly technical methods used of two or even three pieces of paper put together, so that a portion of it inside has a very faint, shadowy watermark on it. They have actually been, by the use of laser printers today, so accurate, and by getting the paper, which is similar, been able to pass off, and that was what was driving the Treasury Department crazy, $100 bills that were done by a PC, a home PC, on a home laser printer that looked so good they were actually able to go and spend them. So they've done that. Well, that's beside the point, but a counterfeit is a counterfeit, and they worship the dragon unknowingly. Not that they're bowing down to a representation of a dragon with a leering face and hissing fire and big bat-like wings, but they're worshiping Satan the devil, which gave power unto the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? Now, what do they say? They don't say, who is like the beast who has given the world such great peace and plenty and prosperity and harmony? Who is like the beast who is so magnanimous? Who is like this great power that has done so much for so many people, has brought peace to all the war-torn world? No, their boast is, no one is bigger or greater or more powerful militarily than this system, this beast. They're proud of his military prowess and his military machinery. Many of you have seen, perhaps many times, the picture of that huge big torchlight parade in Nuremberg beneath the gigantic colonnaded facade where there was a huge big swastika up on top of it. If you investigate, even in the Catholic Encyclopedia under the article cross, you will see that the swastika is the most ancient form of the cross and is so listed in all of archaeology and history. And it was all through Southeast Asia, in India and other nations long before it was ever used of Hitler. Here were hundreds of thousands of people, all of them lined up in gargantuan huge blocks of men. Here was Hitler and his top men coming down this long, long walkway between all these hundreds of thousands with torchlights everywhere, coming up to the platform. They then stood there. Hitler had a particular flag. There was then the presentation, one after another, of these troops marching and goose-stepping up there with their banners and then dipping their flag to touch his flag and thus consecrating it. And they had a gigantic torchlight rally in front of this huge, big swastika. You've seen the picture many, many times, how in 1945, after Germany surrendered, and before the Nuremberg trials began, they went down there to that massive, huge pavilion, and they went up and put dynamite beneath that big stone swastika, and they just blew it all to bits. And you've also seen, I'm pretty sure, the pictures in the documentaries over the 50-some years that have gone by, of that vast torch-lit ceremony that had all the pagan overtones of worship. You've seen the pictures, I would imagine, of Hitler going through town and city in after city in Germany with women looking at him. Some of the Nazi film footage has been displayed in these documentaries over the years, and literally fainting away with just looking at him go by standing up in an open touring car. People have written, including, I've read many books on the subject, including even what Goering himself said, when a British newsman who had come in for an audience with Hitler in 1937 or 8 couldn't understand why a great big hulking fat man like Hermann Goering would quaver. Hitler came into the room, and Goering, who was swaggering around and everything, visibly changed. And the man who was the British newsman saw it, and he asked him later, he said, "I can understand why perhaps Goebbels would be a little bit in awe of Der Führer, but," he said, "here you are, a great, big, powerfully built man. Why did you tremble and turn gray? Why did you act that way in front of him?" And he said, "You have never seen Der Führer in one of his rages." I believe that Satan, the devil himself, possessed the mind of Adolf Hitler. That is my belief. I know that he had the mind of a wild, raging, predatory animal, or he could not have instituted the pogroms that he did. But even as God imposed upon all the Gentile nations down through the course of history during the time of the Gentiles from the 2520-year period, the minds of wild animals, and that is not over yet, by the way, so it well may be that there will be a literal period of time when that will happen again in the future. All right, there was given unto him a mouth. He has a spokesman or a mouthpiece speaking great things and blasphemies. It's not his mouth. It's not him that is making his statements, but he is given a mouth, speaking these great blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 3.5 years. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. Where are the saints? Are they in Petra? Are they in heaven? Have they been spirited away or snatched away from the roofs, right through the rooftops of their automobiles and taken away in secret to be protected from the great tribulation? The Bible says that the beast and the false prophet are going to persecute and make war against the saints and, quote, shall prevail over them. Now let's go back. We'll come back to this just a little later, to the 7th chapter of the book of Daniel. These great empires are all depicted here, one after another, and the very same animals that we read of in the 13th chapter, the first part, are depicted here. Chapter 7, he sees four great beasts, verse 3. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. He beheld till the wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, made to stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it, harking back to what we read about Nebuchadnezzar's insanity. And so it is a lion with eagle's wings. I've gone before in great detail with you through the first and the 10th chapters of the book of Ezekiel. What were the cherubim? What did they look like? They looked like men, lions, eagles, and oxen. And what did the great huge statues that decorated the Ishtar gate leading into Babylon, Ashurbanipal, Ashurnasirpal, and some of the other great palaces of the Assyrian and Babylonian kings, but a huge ox-like body with eagle's wings, with a man's head, look at the Sphinx, and with sometimes lion's claws or even a lion's tail on an oxen. You see all of these four parts throughout the Middle East in the great monuments of Egypt, like the Sphinx, as I said, and in Babylon, and in certainly in Greece as well as in Rome, but mostly over in the east part of Persia and ancient Babylon and Akkad, Sumeria, and Assyria. And behold, another beast, a second like unto a bear, verse 5. And there's the destruction of these other nations, that it says, behold, like a leopard, verse 6, and that was Greco-Macedonia. And it had four heads. That's the four generals that divided up the kingdom even before the body of Alexander was buried. After this, verse 7, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. It was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. The 10 toes and the 10 horns are representative of the same thing, as we will see. I consider the horns, but there were 10 horns in succession down through history, and then the final system is going to have 10 horns who will be contemporaneous. These first three were the horns, successive governments that came along in the ancient Romish kingdom, even during the time that it was overthrown by the Vandals, the Ostrogoths, and the Heruli. I consider the horns, and behold, there came up from among them another little horn. Now, Daniel is seeing this in a vision. He sees a little horn among all these other horns, before whom three of the first horn were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were the eyes. You've never seen a horn with eyes, but this was like a horn of some kind, maybe a big goat's or a sheep's horn, and it suddenly had eyes in it. And below the eyes was a mouth. And like the cartoon of the special effects that I'm talking about, in the technicolor vision that he saw a horn. Then he saw some eyes in the horn. Then he saw a mouth below the eyes, and he realized the mouth was making huge pronouncements. It was like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. I beheld till the thrones were cast down. These great horns, leaders, governors, rulers, sitting on thrones, they were cast down. And the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. Read both the first and the 10th chapters of Ezekiel. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. From this vision, many churches take the picture of the great judgment day. And that's where a lot of people get the idea that there is going to be a vast army of people coming forward one after another to be judged. You get up to heaven and you go down to hell, and here will be the great white throne judgment, and this is the picture of it. Well, the point you want to make here is that he beheld till all of these events began to occur, meaning that the events once begun by a little horn having the eyes of a man and a mouth beneath it speaking great things continue up until the casting down of earthly thrones and the setting up of the throne of the Ancient of Days. Now I beheld, he said in verse 11, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. Now I won't turn to Revelation 19:11 to verse 21, but you can read that, and you will read there that the very first thing Christ is going to do when he returns to the earth is to seize the beast and the false prophet and drag them down to the precipice of Gehenna and throw them over into Gehenna fire. And this is exactly the corroboration of that. As concerning the rest of the beast, they had their dominion taken away. Yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time, a short while. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven. Here is Matthew 24, 29 to 32. Here is 1 Thessalonians 4, 17. Here is 1 Corinthians 15, 50 to 52. Here is Revelation 19, 11 to 21. The second coming of Christ. He came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, so it's depicting God the Father there. And they brought him near before him, and it was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom. So the stone that is cut out without hands, that smashes the image which is portraying all the great world-ruling empires down to the time of the second coming of Christ, which smashes it on its toes, 10 of them, 5 on each side, and for so many years, 5 nations were on the west during the Cold War, and 5 nations were on the east during the Cold War, and like any statue that stands there with its feet spread a certain amount, we thought that that had significance all during that time, and maybe indeed it did. And I was saying that eventually there was going to be a reunification of Germany and a uniting of Europe, and all of those nations for over 45 years that were under Soviet domination were going to come out from behind the Iron Curtain and form a United States of Europe. And that is actually happening. There was given him dominion, a kingdom, and all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. So that is the second time in the 7th chapter of Daniel, that the visions that he saw began clear back at ancient Babylon, came rapidly through Persia, Greco-Macedonia, Rome, through the 10 successive revivals of Rome, down to the last end-time resurrection of Rome, to the 10 nations comprising the beast of Revelation 17, 12 to 14, and the second coming of Christ. Twice so far in the same chapter, Daniel's prophecy uttered clear back in about 537 or so B.C. goes right down through history, all of profane history attesting to the absolute veracity and accuracy of this. Persia did supersede Babylon. And Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Great superseded Persia. And Rome superseded them. Greco-Macedonia superseded Persia, and then Rome superseded Greco-Macedonia, and has had all these revivals, and is emerging again before our very eyes, and it will eventually be called, no doubt, a Holy Roman Empire. Do you know where the treaty that created a united Europe was signed? In Rome. It is called the Treaty of Rome. Go home and look it up on your PC and search the web and just type in Treaty of Rome and read about it. And you can read all of the various documents there that have to do with that treaty that actually formed the united Europe that has emerged today. The Treaty of Rome. All right, in verse 17, these great beasts which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. So that's the third time that it leads up to the time of the intervention of God and the second coming of Christ. Then you wanted to know about that fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, verse 19, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue of his feet, and of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I beheld, and the same horn, what horn? Even that horn that had eyes, and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints, and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. That is the fourth time in the 7th chapter of Daniel that it leads right up to the intervention of God, the second coming of Christ, and what is happening to the saints at that time. Read Revelation 6 and the four horsemen of the apocalypse that are the first four aspects of the great tribulation. False Christ and false prophets, wars and rumors of wars, droughts and famines, then disease epidemics. And then finally, the fifth seal, religious persecution and martyrdom. The sixth seal, the vast heavenly signs. It halts all human activity or there wouldn't be a man, woman, or child left alive on the face of the earth. Because we see the heavenly signs, millions who have been warned, and there's no way they will know unless they had been warned, will drop to their knees at that time, the 144,000, 12,000 of every tribe of Israel, save Dan. Dan says in the prophecy clear back in Genesis 49, I will wait for thy salvation, O Lord. And that's because Dan will be a part of that great system that is ruled over by a great city, which has ruled over kings of the earth for all of these millennia, and probably will be part and parcel of the very group that seeks to overthrow the United States and Britain, and will cooperate with them. And so Dan, which we believe is Ireland, because the first people that landed there were called the Tuatha de Danann, and the first people who colonized Ireland were Danites. Half of Dan abode in ships. It says very plainly, it says in Genesis, I will wait for thy salvation, O Lord. So the 144,000 give a double portion to Joseph, which is Ephraim and Manasseh. 12,000 to both Ephraim and Manasseh. There are 12 tribes, only when you count all of them, like you can recite them in your own mind, I'm sure, but you only get to Joseph, but Joseph had two sons, and then when aged Israel was dying, he crossed his hands, and he blessed Ephraim and Manasseh, and said, let my name be named on them. So the tribes who wear the title House of Israel are primarily Ephraim and Manasseh, not Gad, Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, Dan, and so on, all the others. In addition to the 144,000, a vast, countless multitude of perhaps millions and millions of people, perhaps millions of people, who will only be converted when they see the heavenly signs. And they're going to finally know this is it. God is sending Christ to this earth. They will have endured all these wars. There will only be a few that are still alive at that time. There will be probably two-thirds, three-fourths, or more of the population of this earth dead by the time the heavenly signs appear in the heavens above. Now, there's one more time. It says the judgment, well, let's read it in verse 25 because it refers to the same religious aspect of the Great Tribulation. Verse 25, he shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change times and laws. And they shall be given into his hand until the time and times and the dividing of time. Where are the saints? Are they given into the caves in Petra? Are they snatched up and are they in the hands of Christ? Or are they given into the hands of this little horn with eyes like a man, with a mouth speaking great things? And are they or are they not under persecution, death? It says, made war with the saints and prevailed against them in verse 21. It said, made war with the saints and prevailed against them in Revelation 13:7. And it says here that he shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and they shall be given into his hand until the time, times, and the dividing of time. 3.5 years. How long is the tribulation to prevail against Israel? 3.5 years. How long is Jerusalem to be trodden down of Gentile armies? 3.5 years. How long is the ministry of the two witnesses to continue? 3.5 years. How long are religious, converted members of God's church to be persecuted, tortured, and even martyred and put to death? 3.5 years. It's all the same period of time. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom unto the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Now you saw that the great, most powerful parts of the first beast of Revelation 13, which is that last great beast that is going to prevail, and is going to invade Palestine and set up his palaces there, according to Daniel 11:40-45, is like it has all the most powerful aspects of its predecessors. The head of the lion, the belly or the body of the leopard, and the great feet of the great bear. Let's now go to the 13th chapter of Revelation again and notice a little bit about the second beast of Revelation 13. To rehearse our memory again, verse 7, it is given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And in verse 10, the patience of the saints is this, that they know that he that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that kills with a sword must be killed with a sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. In other words, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. They do not fight back. They don't pick up AK-47s and try to shoot it out with army soldiers or policemen to trigger some kind of a prophetic event in a self-fulfilling prophecy. They are, as Jesus Christ said, people who will literally turn the other cheek. They are people who will not fight back. They are people who are persecuted because of the work they do, because of their belief, because of their conversion, and because of the knowledge they possess of who in fact is the false prophet. And what is the great false mystery religion, Babylon the Great? Where is that city which has reigned over the kings of the earth? And what are its deceptions? Verse 11, I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and it had two horns like a lamb. So it appears Christ-like, lamb-like. And he spake as a dragon, but it's with the voice of Satan the devil, his deceptions. He exercises all the power of the first beast before him. So he is able to use the military power. What is it that the worshipful people were saying about the beast? Who is able to make war against him? You know very well how much the throngs in the streets of Berlin and other great cities of Germany just chilled and thrilled when the rumbling columns of tanks and armor would go by, even as the Soviet Union on May Day would parade its gigantic missile launchers and the hundreds of thousands would cheer and scream. And those nations that really worship militarism, it is like state worship. There is such a thing as the subjugation of individual aspirations to the state, so that as the state grows and as the state prospers, everything that the state has as its geopolitical aims, called in those days realpolitik and Drang nach Osten and Lebensraum, becomes a frustration which is only fulfilled in the desires of the individual by seeing the state accomplish such great things. I could go off on a tangent and preach you a sermon for 1 hour about why people scream the way they do at a hockey match or an ice hockey match or a football game or a basketball game or at a golf tournament or at a boxing match. But it's because they identify with their hero, their champion, their team, which are almost always named after animals or something like that. And we have won. That's why when the Super Bowl happens, they burn down the city. You hate to think of what they would do if they lost. But they get out and overturn cars, set them afire, and loot, and break into buildings and all of that, and fight it out with the police because they won the Super Bowl. There is a vicarious excitement and enjoyment that people experience, and especially in nations that are militaristic, as Germany has always been, when they see something like that happening. It is state worship. Now, he exercises the power of the first beast. So this second lamb-like beast, Christ-like, but speaking as Satan, is able to exercise the military power of the first beast that we've read about and read about and read about. And causeth the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. So they are in total collusion. It says in the 17th chapter, I'll go ahead to that right quickly now. We'll come back to the 13th. You want to keep your place there. That he saw a great whore who sits upon many waters, verse 1, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. They have diplomatic and full economic, social, spiritual ties with this great fallen woman that is the picture of a great false church. The inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine, Greek word oinos in passing. So oinos is a word which can cause drunkenness when you drink it in excess. Of her fornication, which means her false doctrines, her lies, her mystery religion. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. Now let's skip over to verse 12 through 14. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings. We get an immediate interpretation. Which have received no kingdom as yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, that's one policy, shall give their power and strength unto the beast, and their power and strength is their economy, their military power, their natural reserves and resources. These shall make war with the Lamb. When are they at the zenith of their power? At the precise moment of the second coming of Christ. And what is happening to the saints at that time? They have been prevailed against. They've been enduring great tribulation for 3.5 years. All organized preaching of the gospel has been over for 3.5 years. The only witness and warning remaining at that time is the two witnesses for 3.5 years. No church, no group, no meeting like this has been able to take place at the time of the second coming of Christ for over 3.5 years. There will be no place that anyone can hide who observes God's Sabbath day and is a part of God's work at that time. Don't worry about whether or not you need to be a martyr. Christ said, some of you they shall put to death. But he said, to others, not a hair of your head shall perish. It depends entirely upon God's will. And does it really make any difference, except for a short period of time, for whatever that means to us as human physical beings, as long as we are secure to God's kingdom? So the 10 horns are 10 kings. They will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. And you can read of that in Revelation 19, 11 through 21. Now, back to where we were in verse 3. Here is a woman that sits upon a scarlet-colored beast. You know, when you ride a horse, you probably got spurs on your boots, a bridle in the horse's mouth, a saddle on the horse, you got a good grip, and you're able to steer or to guide that horse and to gig it with the spears to make it do your bidding. Turn where you want it to turn, go where you want it to go, stop when you want it to stop. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, the colors traditionally of harlotry. You might want to check that out and think a little bit about what religious orders wear those colors. Decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Read Isaiah 47, of how she says, I will sit a queen and am no widow and shall see no sorrow. And the same thing is repeated in Revelation 18 and verse 7. And that is to take place during the time of Jacob's trouble, and that the yoke that will be laid upon the people of Jacob, meaning Ephraim and Manasseh, is the yoke of the combined armies of the beast at the behest of the woman who rides the beast, who is depicted here. I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints, not drunken with the blood of horrible bad people who need to shed their blood so that they can get into God's kingdom, the argument that some people have advanced to make people feel absolutely inferior, like they're never going to be able to qualify for God's kingdom, and to think that there is going to come a division where God is going to somehow purge, look at the word purgatory, purge sins through torture. That is a doctrine of Satan the devil and not of God. God purges sins by breaking your heart, not your little finger. God wants to break your heart, not your legs. God doesn't want to torture anyone. He wants people to see what the consequences of sin are and to repent of it. And when we repent and call out to Him with tears and breaking heart on our knees, God forgives us of our sins. There was a doctrine that was extant in the parent church, which is no longer even our parent or any resemblance to any family member, that those who were going to be thrown into the great tribulation were thrown there in order to expurgate the last little secret sins out of their evil little minds so they could be purified for the kingdom of God. And the doctrine of purgatory is the same thing. You're dead, and allegedly you have a soul, which you don't, and the soul is supposed to go to purgatory, and the prayers and the almsgiving of your loved ones and neighbors and so on over a vast period of time for all the remaining evil little things that were in your mind and heart when you died will eventually be expurgated and expunged, and you will be allowed into the beatific vision. I read something on that just this morning in the Catholic Encyclopedia. It was going through their concept of purgatory. Once again, believe me, it is a little bit gruesome. Now, I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints. Who are these people? They are saints. They are converted, godly, God-fearing, praying, merciful, loving human beings who have been converted, repented of their sins, been baptized, and received God's Holy Spirit. And with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great awe, not admiration the way we think of it today. Admiration has been basically changed in its meaning. He's not admiring it in the way we would take it, but he is stricken in great, vast awe, and probably standing aghast would be a greater term. And the angel said, "Why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and the beast that carries her, that has seven heads and ten horns. The beast that you saw was, it was in the past, the Holy Roman Empire, and is not. And that there was ever a time in human history where we live at the moment where we are reading an expression in biblical prophecy that applies to the instantaneous, immediate future. It is this word, is not, or this expression, was, and is not, and shall ascend out of the figurative bottomless pit or the abyss and go into destruction." So it's the last one. It ascends out of this figurative abyss and goes into perdition. "And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is." They will wonder when they behold it in its military power, in its gigantic economic power, in its ability to become the world's, at that time, only superpower. Here is the mind which has wisdom. Does your mind have wisdom? The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. Is there a great city that is known for its seven hills? And there are seven kings. Five are fallen. One is, the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not is the eighth. It's an eighth system, but is of the seven and goes into perdition, the final, last one. And the ten horns, we read, are ten kings, and they will make war, verse 14, with the Lamb. Now, verse 16, "The ten horns which you saw upon the beast, these will hate the whore, and will make her desolate and naked, and eat her flesh and burn her with fire, for God has put it in their hearts to fulfill his will." When they see what happens after the occupation of Palestine, Daniel 11, 40 to 45, tidings out of the north and out of the east trouble him. I look today at what is happening, and tidings out of the north and out of the east, and that's not the fulfillment of that prophecy. I'm just saying because of it is reminiscent of that prophecy that the figurative river Euphrates will be dried up to prepare the way of the kings of the east, that here is China saber-rattling, sending rockets up, sending a satellite into space, having free stage now solid fuel rockets with at least 11 to 14 ICBMs capable of reaching any American city save the southern part of Florida. Here is Russia once more drifting back into the Cold War as a result of what our president and NATO have done, where everything that had been accomplished in the time of Eisenhower through George Bush had softened up, finally created the actual implosion of the Soviet Union, the disintegration of that great, huge, monolithic power, allegedly retargeting their ballistic missiles so that they're not aimed at us anymore. You know how quickly they can be retargeted? Quicker than I can send an email to Chris of about three paragraphs. Somebody sits down at a computer, simply looks up the lat long of Chicago, punches it in, says insert, bang, they're retargeted because it's merely a computer program in the guidance system, which is a inertial navigation system and also uses GPS to guide those ballistic missiles right down to their target within about 3 yards of ground zero. And they're doing that now, apparently. So that's where we are. But when I think about the vastness of China and to think about Russia in full mobilization and Russia now stepping up its draft from 18 to 27 years of age and think about all that is happening in the world right now, I'm beginning to wonder whether or not in the next 2, 3, 4 years, there's going to be protracted war, more and more nations gradually getting into it, war finally expanding to where a multilateral European force will advance down into Palestine and will occupy it, and a great religious leader who was shot and has been healed will maybe go down there, and as of this moment that I'm speaking to you, he is scheduled to go there in 2000. Allegedly, sometime later this year or next year at the very latest, Yasser Arafat is going to declare a Palestinian state. If they do, then a Palestinian state will have full sovereignty and be able to invite any other power it wishes with its armor or its aircraft or its tanks into its sovereign territory to, quote, defend it, end quote, against the Israelis. We're living in times that people ought to take seriously and to understand. It says, the woman which you saw, verse 18, is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. What city is it? Oslo? Did it ever reign over all the kings of the earth? Tokyo? Chicago? Washington, D.C.? Rawlins, you know, Wyoming? Where? What great city is it all the way down through history who has actually crowned kings or deposed kings by interdiction? Why, it's Rome. In Halley's Bible Handbook, page 726, it gives you something about the origin of the word Latinos. L-A-T-E-I-N-O-S. In Greek, the spelling is L-A-T-E-I-N-O-S. And L in the Greek numerical value is 30. A is 1, T is 300, E is 5, we know Roman numeral 1 is 10, N is 50, O is 70, S is 200. If you add that up, it comes to 666. So that not only Romulus and his name is stamped indelibly on that city, who was the founder of Rome, and his name also in Greek or Latin adds up to 666. Latin, or the word Latinos, means Latin kingdom. And Latin is the official language of Papal Rome and always has been. It is the language of their encyclicals, their canons, their missals, their prayers, their decrees, their bulls, blessings or cursings, and it is the language of their mass. It is all in Latin, and Latinos means Latin kingdom. Now let's go to the 13th chapter of Revelation once again. It says that this great beast that rises up that looks Christ-like and yet speaks as the devil, verse 13, doeth great wonders, so that he makes fire come down from heaven on earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by the sword and did live. We've known for many, many decades, and of course many of the biblical handbooks and other scholars have also known, that ancient imperial Rome, which consisted of the lesser and the greater diocese, was actually the pattern for the growing universal church. If you look up in the Catholic Encyclopedia or any encyclopedia, such words as diocese, curia, collegia, you will begin to understand. Look up the word metropolitan. Look up the word bishopric or bishop. And you will see that as it gradually began to grow, a bishop, which was over a city, would then be superseded by the largest city of 5 or 6 or 8 or 10, because the ancient Roman Empire was divided into 12 segments called a great diocese, each one a greater diocese. Logically, they probably took the 12 from the Bible. The idea of 12 segments, 12 tribes of Israel, 12 gates into the holy city. And there were 12 of the great dioceses. So when this church began to develop, it took the governmental pattern of ancient imperial Rome and adapted them to an ecclesiastical structure. So you have the beast, which is imperial Rome, and you have an image of the beast, which is made like a pattern of it, but is a religious organization. A metropolitan was then finally superseded by a great patriarch. Eventually, there were many great patriarchs, but finally, through death, through war, and through arguments and antagonism between them, there ended up only two, one in Constantinople and the other in Rome, and they finally split and went their separate ways. The iconoclastic controversy came along, and you've got the Greek Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church. Now then, I want to go back before we come to a few more verses here to one quick chapter, and then we're near the end of this, over in 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter. We're very familiar with this, but let's take another quick look at it. Paul beseeches them not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or letter, as if it were from them, that the day of Christ is at hand. Verse 3, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day will not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God. I know some people have been tempted to try to say that that is the leader of one of the segments or others, or perhaps the parent church. Some people actually were applying that to Joseph Tkach, who is now long since dead. They really were. Some of these split-off groups decided the man of sin who emerges in the midst because of that Greek word ginomai that seems to imply that he will become to be instead of the word taken out of the way in verse 7, the last four words of it, last five words. The Greek word there is ginomai, and I'll come to that in due course. That is not what is implied here, because notice what Paul said. Who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God. Now they claim that means a church. No way. You can draw an analogy if you like, but it's going to be inaccurate because the temple still stood when Paul wrote these words. And his audience in Thessalonica knew where the temple was. It was still about 21 more years or so before that temple was going to fall, about maybe 17 or 18 years, from 55 approximately to 71 AD. The temple still stood. There is no doubt what Paul had in mind and what he wanted those people to understand when he wrote this. Showing himself that he is God, claiming the very powers of God, which is blasphemy beyond belief. Remember you not that when I was yet with you I told you these things, and now you know what withholds that he might be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity. What did we read in Revelation 17? Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. It is a mystery religion. Just the other day on television I saw someone that was saying, well, we have wondered and wondered and argued and talked and so on for centuries about the nature of God. They make God into a mystery. They make his nature past finding out. Instead of what you read in Jesus' own statements, he that has seen me has seen the Father, and Hebrews 1, that he was the exact stamped impress of the exact character of God the Father, that the Father did the works in and through him. There is a Father, there is a Son, and we are called children of God. We're to be born of God. And instead of God as a family, which he portrays himself to us as a family throughout the Bible, they have completely thrown that away in what used to be the parent church and have made God into an hypostasis, going all the way back to the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD and adopting the same old pagan mystery religion around which this great emerging apostate church built all of its doctrines. And there they are, wearing their crucifixes, eating their pork, eating bread during the days of unleavened bread, and going to worship together on the day of the sun. Well, maybe there is some little shadowy type that people can draw there, but the man himself is long since dead of cancer. Now he said, you know who or what withholdeth that he might be revealed in his time? For the mystery of iniquity does already work. It was at work there. Look at Simon Magus and look at all of his warnings of the Ephesian elders. Read the book of Jude. Look at the fact that all New Testament literature is essentially a recounting of the efforts of the true apostles of God to keep the church free from heresy. To keep the church free from error. Read 1 Corinthians over again. Read all of these letters of the Apostle Paul. Look what Paul warned Timothy. The time will come when they will heap to themselves teachers having itching ears. when they will not endure sound doctrine. He says, preach the word, be instant, in season, out of season. Do not preach the way they want, smooth things and deceits, etc. And all through the New Testament is showing that there was a mystery of iniquity. Read the letters to the churches in Revelation 2 and 3. The Nicolaitans, Jezebel, teaching them to commit fornication and eat things sacrificed to idols. It was already emerging and raising its head throughout the New Testament church. And finally, there was a lost century from the close of the first century and the death of John until the emergence of the third century. And a whole century has virtually disappeared from history. And by the time the curtain is raised on the developing church, it is completely different from the church that Christ started. It is now observing Sunday. It is now observing Ishtar. It is not observing the Lord's Supper or the Passover on the 14th of Nisan any further. Well, he says here, then shall that wicked one, as it should read, that's why it has a capital W, be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. That is the false prophet that we read in Revelation 19 will be thrown into Gehenna. Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders. All power, signs, and lying wonders. And with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that are perishing, as it should read, because they received not the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this cause, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie. Now back to Revelation 13 and verse 14. He will deceive them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. I know what it means down through history. I know what it means metaphorically, but brethren, what if this could be literal? What if there is going to come a time when the great general who will masquerade as the savior of Europe and the savior of Israel and the savior of the world, who will, through his military power, occupy Palestine, the Balkans, and a whole area, and forcibly bring peace? What if they erect a statue to him? What if it's over 100 feet high? What if it's gilded with gold? And then what if this occurs? He had power to give life to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak. What if they make such a statue, and what if someday, before a mass crowd of countless thousands, the statue speaks? What church is it that has speaking statues, bleeding statues, weeping statues, apparitions and appearances and signs and wonders? What if? I'm not saying that's what is implied here. I'm saying, is it possible? Is it possible that Satan the devil could cause a statue to speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed? Will there be foisted upon people something? Do people bow before statues anywhere in the world? Do people take little symbols that they wear around their necks or have on the covers of their Bibles or dangling from their rearview mirror or in their homes or in little niches or grottos or caves or atop their steeples and churches and sanctuaries and basilicas? And do they bow before it? Do they bow before altars where there are either icons or statuary? Are people accustomed to that? Are there people anywhere who think if they went to a certain place at a certain time, a statue might sweat or bleed, or speak? Yes, there are. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. It's always important to great kingdoms and governments to have a symbol. It's always important to have a sign. Hitler had the swastika and the Nazi salute and the Hail Caesar, except it was Heil. And Sieg Heil is victory. Hail to victory. Sieg Heil. Victory. Hail. Will there come a time when somewhere in Europe, or in Rome, or even in Jerusalem, there will be a great, tall, gilded statue made to a great military champion who has done great and wondrous things? And will it be a symbol of the great power that is going to invade Palestine and which Christ will destroy at his coming? It says in Daniel, the second chapter, only in a dream, that a stone is cut out without hands, and it comes down like a meteor striking earth and smashes the great image on its toes, and the whole thing disintegrates and is carried away like the chaff of the summer threshing floor. Could it also be, could it be, I just speculate and I ask, that at the time of the second coming of Christ, there will be an image, literally, that he will smash into dust and it will disappear, and his kingdom will be established. And since he is coming to the Mount of Olives, where might that image be placed? It's something to think about. It's not something that I'm positive of, but it does say that the image of the beast will speak, and I know what that means down through history, and I know what it means with regard to a great false prophet and a great false church thinking to change times and laws and actually persecuting God's people. Whether or not it will be a literal image that will be built, maybe, maybe not, but it's something we probably ought to think about.